Hey guys, it's KP here. There's a message before this episode to let you guys know real quickly. We had to bum rush the very end of this. My beautiful, handsome delf of a dad was a bit of a windbag on this one. And I'm kidding, obviously. Our guest knew a lot about the topic. I wanted to bring a lot about the topic. My father researched way over the top for the topic, which, as you are going to see, is Jim Thorpe. And we wanted to put this episode out the week of the Super Bowl because he had such an NFL legacy. However, we were running so late and poor Kahuna had to go out and put out a fire because another podcast was supposed to be in here. So we apologize to those guys. We're sorry we ran late. But that being said, guys, we do have to speed through the very end of this one. So you're going to hear it almost ending abruptly. So I just want you to be aware of that one. We cover everything about Jim Thorpe's life. But at the very end, we have to kind of cascade past the part where his remains were taken and his wife kind of sold his dead body to create a town in Pennsylvania. So more on that later. You guys are understanding. We do cover all the information, but we just get like a cocaine panic freak out towards the very end. But guys, do me a favor and please enjoy Jim Thorpe, American Loser.
It don't matter what I try. I just can't win and I don't know why. There's a fork in every road. I pick the wrong one and then I go. American loser, yes I am. Disenfranchised from everything. Well, I fall up and I fall down. An American loser the day I was born.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Where else could we be? You're back on American Loser. It's the spotlight. It's firmly on second place here on this podcast. Set it backwards, but we're going to keep it. We got places to be, things to do. All right? So not for nothing, guys. I'm KP Burke. I'm your host on this show. With me, as always, who other than my father, the dilf of a dad, Lawrence Patrick. How are you?
Hey, we're just doing wonderful. Couldn't be any better.
I hear you. Where are we, Dad?
We are at the shared universe in our own lovely garden spot of a nation, Eatontown, New Jersey.
We sure are, man. Mike and Ming take great care of us as always. Not for nothing. Real quick, unofficial sponsor of the show. I'm going to make him a sponsor of the show. Dad, right. You were drinking a beer. Actually, you're drinking a beer on air right now.
Well, yeah, I guess.
What kind of beer are you drinking?
We're doing a Ross beer.
A Ross beer.
That is Ross Brewery.
The Navasink IPA.
Okay? There you go.
And our guest is going to be our subject matter expert on that here. But first, who's behind the ones and twos other than
The Big Kahuna. What's up, you guys? How you doing?
Thanks for sneaking us in today, buddy. I appreciate
you. No problem.
It's lots of good stuff going on here. We've had we're trying to get as many episodes recorded before my dad turns into South Beach Larry again. So it's going to happen.
Getting a little chilly, folks. Gotta start heading south.
It is. There was a wind today.
Just a little?
Cut through us, you know?
Yeah.
Felt it down in our bones. But not for nothing. Returning guests, because that's what I think we found here. We do have some good guests that come on that are either one-offs or we just haven't had a chance to bring them back on yet again. But when we have a guest that understands the show and listens to the show, they tend to be quality guests. And one of the quality guests we have is one of my great friends in comedy, all right? I feel like I say that a lot, but I really mean it with this guy. I'm not fluffing it up so I can just get through the awkwardness. Marcus Aurelius Ricadonis joins us here on the show.
Long time listener, third time caller.
There you go.
Touche, man.
Well, it's good to have you back.
I love being here. You guys are the best.
Like we said, you are the only guest that has come on here. Well, there's a couple other guests. Everybody loves the Kahuna when they come on, but you're the only guest that has actually done outside work with the Kahuna.
Oh, man. The Kahuna's the man. He came over. He may have made my son become a work in the film industry. He watched Kahuna at work, and now he's obsessed.
It's the truth, man. It's well, Kahuna when he's fully engaged is
he's
a dangerous man.
He's magical.
He's a dangerous man.
I like how you went dangerous and you went magical, but then went back and forth. Like, is it dangerous? Is it magical?
And when you can take Mark's 5-year-old son and just like he's completely enthralled with the magic of the Kahuna.
Does. Right. Right, they talked about Thomas for hours. Then they worked on film together. They talked about lighting. I felt like the stepchild. I shouldn't have been there.
It had nothing to do with the flashy lights that he was controlling on the soundboard there. It was all Kahuna.
You really are.
It wasn't bells and whistles and flashy LEDs. It was all him.
That is wild. No, he is designed to be fascinating. First of all, I find you fascinating, and I'm 32 years old. Now imagine a 5-year-old. You're like, wait a minute, you write for Thomas the Tank Engine?
Right. You
make
willingly?
You make your own Muppets?
Again, willingly? That's a-
Axel's like, the gods do walk among us.
What's up, Axel?
Well, we got a good one here for you today, and we got places to be, like I said. Uncle Paulie's cooking dinner for us, so we have to be on time for that. That is, otherwise, that rapscallion of a gentleman gets a little... I'm going to say ornery, Dad. Is that fair to say?
He gets a keener edge than his normal edge.
Oh, yeah. And it'll be passive-aggressive, too. It'll be like, oh, well, you know, the dinner would have been hot if you were here on time.
Nobody likes a miffed
Uncle Paulie.
Uncle Paulie.
The Italian who married into the family. But now, not for nothing, Mark. You currently reside in the great state of Pennsylvania. Is that true?
I do.
You're outside of Philly still, right?
Yep. Ambler, okay. Pennsylvania.
Fantastic. Now, how far away is that from... what was once known as Ma Chunk, Pennsylvania.
Ma Chunk? Do you mean Jim Thorpe? We actually live right down the turnpike from it. It's probably get there in about 40 minutes.
Well, I first found out about this because we've created a universe now in this whole American Loser thing where there's enough going on and there's enough characters at play that we have those Game of Thrones moments where the two storylines kind of fall in on one another. So
yeah, many storylines overlap.
So now the Molly Maguire's episode, one of my favorites, Cousin Kate came in for that one, and we covered the true mafioso / labor union that was the Molly Maguire's. If you want to learn about them, please check that episode. That was a very fun one. So the towns that a lot of that took place in was Ma Chunk, that has now been renamed after, as Mark said, this week's American Loser, who was once again into the mic, buddy.
Jim Thorpe.
Cahoons, what do you know about Jim Thorpe off the top of your head?
That's it.
Wow. You know the name, right?
Yeah, the name does ring a bell.
Well, because as scouts growing up, we would go whitewater rafting in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, was it not?
Well, close by, yep.
Very nearby. So.
Wait, was it a recent rename that they did? Or is it like...
Recent enough, I'll put it that way. It was. We're going to cover this story today. When we talk about this guy's life, I think it's fair to say that it starts off as just, okay, this is an interesting story. And then you're going to think that we're just making shit up.
Right, right.
This guy's the greatest athlete to ever, ever live, and nobody knows who he is.
But it's so weird because everybody knows his name. They just don't know what it was that he accomplished. And not for nothing, in his own life, I don't think he knew what he was going to even be truly remembered for. But not for nothing. Mark, where were you in 1999?
I was about to graduate high school.
Scary time, right? You're about to be out of high school. It's the new millennium. The world's about to end.
Yeah. I just moved to New York City, and 99 to 2000, I was actually living in Times Square right at the... actually went to that ball drop.
I don't want to tell people what you were doing in Times Square, but let me just say that he wore a giant red suit and told everybody to tickle him.
That's what you did for a living?
This was way before Times Square would allow an Elmo in there. There was a lot of tickle me stuff, but it was not Elmo.
Reach into your pocket slowly. I know it gets hurt.
So, but
listen, I'm just going to let it end there because I can do a scary good Elmo and I'm not going to do it.
I'll tell you what, at the very end, I want to hear it.
Oh,
that's how we're going to keep the listeners engaged.
Not with Elmo.
And I do want you to think about, they did make a movie about this guy's life, but I do want you to think about if you had to make a movie now, I do want to go back to Kahuna's casting couch. I want to get back to that. It was a good segment.
Oh, yeah. That was a thing I did.
But not for nothing here, guys. I remember the end of 1999 as a mix of things. There was the Yankees baseball dynasty that entertained me in my youth. There was the important battle of Stone Cold Steve Austin versus The Rock. And a certain blonde girl that sat behind me in all my classes in sixth grade who was so pretty that I pretty much took a year off from farting.
Oh, okay. At least in that class.
Oh, God.
How much weight did you gain in that year? Just swelling up.
Remember when the guy loses his mind at the end of Big Trouble in Little China? That's kind of what I looked like halfway through class. But... Now, it was a cool thing to be witnessing the end of the year, a decade, a century, and hell, even a millennium. We're never going to see that again. But I always thought it was cool because there's all these lists that were coming out at the time. So there were lists for what was the quote, best of the century, best albums, best movies, best moments. One kind of stuck out, though. I remember having a book, and it was the all-time greatest baseball teams, right? And in my mind, the greatest baseball player of all time was Don Mattingly. Okay. Now I'm short on that list. There's a lot of other players that are probably ahead of
him. It's because of your mustache fetish, but
Call me out on that one here, man. I truly regret shaving, by the way. But the thing that stuck out for me was that the best athlete of the 1900s. Now, mind you, that there's always that screwed up thing too to confuse everybody. It's the 1900s or the 20th century. That's always screwed
there you
up.
Go.
Yeah. I can never figure
I've
that.
Never figured it out. Still nope. To this day, I don't know what
from 1900 to 1999.
That's
that's the time span.
But this should be the 900s. Yeah. I'm really bad at math, okay? They tried the Chicago method of math. It did not work out good for us. In this voting, I thought this was very interesting. The best athlete of the 1900s. Who are the names that jump off the list for you, Mark, at the top here?
You would think somebody like Michael Jordan.
Of course.
You would think Don Manning, Lou Gehrig or Mickey Mantle.
Lou Gehrig would pop up there too, for sure. Babe Ruth. Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
Wayne Gretzky. Mm-hmm. All right. And like we said, even probably the guy who should win is Michael Jordan, just because I don't think anybody's ever.
Curly from the Harlem Globetrotters.
Curly. There you go. There you go.
But get this, all those guys were nominated, and the award was won by a guy who, like many losers on this list, is a name that people are going to recognize, but they're not quite sure why. So as per the ABC Sports poll for the best athlete of the 20th century, it's today's loser, Mr. Jim Thorpe.
Does he have a stupid skyway named after him?
No. The title of this episode is, I'm the World's Greatest Athlete, and All I Got Was This Lousy Town in PA.
Depressed town.
But here's a name for you. All right, Mark, what's your middle name?
Anthony.
I figured. Mark Anthony Riccatoni.
You're all named Tony somewhere.
We can't really talk much. There's no middle name other than Patrick in our family. Yeah,
that's a tough one to get around.
But get this one. Baptized Jacobus Franciscus Thorpe in the Catholic Church. Jim Thorpe was born in what was known as Indian Territory, Native American Territory, to be politically correct with a modern parlance, Dad. But
there's a lot of stuff, though, as you should warn the listeners, there's going to be a lot of stuff that's politically incorrect during this episode because, unfortunately, the way history, the cards fell.
History was politically incorrect.
Yeah. And then also, not for nothing, there is that idea of, like, if you're progressive for your time 30 years from now, you're racist. So that's all I have. Like, you could be, you're like, no, you don't understand. That's how we talked in that day. And this was, I was giving people the respect they deserved and everything. You're like, no, you're using the term, blah, 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 whatever.
Well, let's be honest. So he had a Native American name. He was born in what was called Indian Country. But every racist.
That was, by the way?
Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Every racist uncle in the world's going to go, yeah, but he was a little Irish. He was part Irish.
Yeah.
Well, that's why he wasn't tall. No, it always made me laugh, too, because in reading that, he is what is considered, first of all, his life is almost like a legend. There's no birth certificate for him. He is baptized, though. If it wasn't for the Catholic Church's record keeping, we wouldn't really know when he was born. They estimate that he was born May 22nd, 1887.
Yeah, they have the baptismal record, but they don't have the birth record.
Right.
So you just subtracting a couple of days from the baptism, and so that's your birthday.
It's kind of like how that book, The Irish Saved Civilization, because the priests kept records.
Right.
You know what I mean? So the religions is the thing, we didn't dissolve into forgetting about, the Roman Empire because of them.
This could be like the Dominican Republic in Little League Baseball, though. He might have got baptized at 18, and that's why he was so.
Baseball has been very, very good to me.
There you go.
No, that's a great move too, man. And he's remained Catholic his whole life too, which I thought was interesting because Jim is like you were saying, he is part Irish. That's true, but he is he's like a mutt's mutt.
He's a perfect example of what America is. He's a little of everything, but he's also a lot Native American. Which
totally
means
I think when you do the math, he works out to be like 5/8 Native American. And the rest is a mix of French, a little Irish, a little of this, a little of that, pinch of salt, a little shake of pepper and whatever.
That's like our boy the Kahuna. He's a little bit of everything. You know what I mean? There's that panda bear meme, too, where it's like, be like a panda. They're black, white, everybody loves him.
Kahuna's the Jim Thorpe of sound.
There you go.
Well, get
but
this
not
one.
Just for one century, for all time.
That's right, all time. That's
I hold the record.
Well, get this. His father was a mix, and his mother was a mix, too. So when you get two mixes mixing together, it's like, again, we're fractions here we're talking about. But Jim's dad was half Irish and half Native American, and his mother was half French and half Native American. Okay, so that makes Jim Irish, French, Sac and Fox Nation, and Potawatomi. Dad, real quickly, the Potawatomi.
There you go.
I could tell you were Potawatomi the second you walked in here.
Look.
You know what it is? Potawatomi guys always wear their pants like that.
You can see them from down the street.
So.
Picking right out of the crowd.
No daughter of mine's dating a Potawatomi. You understand? You're going to date a Sac and Fox Nation kid, all right? It's a proud Cherokee line in this family. But not for nothing, Dad. There's a tribe name. Obviously, the Potawatomi is a very interesting name here. But there's a name that jumps out at you. The Sac and Fox Nation. What the hell is that?
Well, a lot of people today are thinking, well, there's Indians, right, or Native Americans. But Native Americans were made up of many, many nations. And the Sac and the Fox Nations are two separate nations, but they were closely aligned in that they spoke a very similar language, which had an Algonquin base, if you will. But they were always kind of lumped together, and they were from the same general geographic area, which is around the Great Lakes, Lake Huron and Mississippi, the upper Mississippi kind of a thing. And early on in the history, which was interesting, I found with Jim Thorpe, is that his heritage came from the Fox and the Sacs and Fox Nations, and at one time they were even at war with the United States. I mean, they were, you know, virtually knocked
Nation,
out of the box.
Fox Nation, that comes on before Bill O'Reilly. Right?
There you go. Right? There you go. Their news broadcast is somewhat slanted, but
Britt McHenry. Sorry about that one. But not for nothing, Dad. The Sac and Fox Nation. If this guy, Jim Thorpe, as Mark pointed out, is being born in Oklahoma, then why is a tribe known for being in the Great Lakes area out in Oklahoma?
Well, it's just because the United States government found a better place for them to reside. In other words, they were forced off their ancestral lands and put on to what became known as Indian Territory.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the eventual landing spot for the Sacs and Fox Nation, Oklahoma. But that was after a number of different, you know, oh, we're going to move you over here and we promise we'll never take this away from you again. And
didn't a war just end? I might just be making this up in my head, but didn't a war just end right before this happened that was with the Native Americans?
Well, there's a whole point, because you're absolutely right, and it comes in later. My father actually has, we're going to save that one weird snippet for the timeline of something. Because if you want to talk about, we don't have any, my whole connection growing up as a kid to the Native American culture was largely through
high school mascots.
A lot of it was that. A lot of it was that for sure. But you don't think twice about it. And then a lot of that comes in from here, by the way, which is another weird asset of the story. But growing up, we had a reverence for it because my father had a reverence for it growing up. So I was always fascinated by I read a lot of James Fenimore Cooper, of course, the great illustrated classics versions, abridged for my dumb eyes.
Got to have pictures.
But yeah. So there was a whole Last of the Mohicans thing. There was it's very hard to rhyme things with Chinachcook.
Eminem can do it.
Yeah, I was going to say, give it to a third grader. They'll figure it out.
Well, it's hard to, you have to rhyme with Chinachcook, but then you also can't curse. It still has to be read by children. But so there was always that reverence that we had with the Native Americans there. And it's it is weird because there's the time in our country. I think of Native Americans, I go back into the past. You know what I mean? Because we're in New Jersey. There's no real connection to it. The people growing up in this time frame of the story, they're all deeply connected to it. We're not far removed from, as we're going to discuss, some of the very tragic events towards the end of the taming of the American West, if you will. But it's remind us of that point here in a second, Mark, because you're going to like where we wind up going with that one.
Just a little side tidbit that I came across, too, that the Sac and Fox Nation had their big moment, if you will, with the Black Hawk War. Black Hawk was a Native American chief that went to war with the United States. I think they were kind of aligned with the British at the time, so when the whole North American continent was being fought over by Europe, European nations, and the United States, this Chief Black Hawk was large and in charge with that particular thing. And President Abraham Lincoln got his very minor military experience as part of the militia that was raised to fight against Black Hawk. So that was his sole military experience, if you will, as a militiaman. But he was also part of burial details and that kind of stuff. He never really saw a battle, but he was involved with a lot of the aftermath. And you got to wonder if that didn't change the guy, too, to, with some of his programs for the Native Americans and as well as for the blacks, as far as, you know, everybody being equal and the whole his attitude towards war. If you're part of the burial detail, you can see what that might change a person. Right?
Yeah, that's not a sought after detail.
Yeah,
I don't
think. Right.
By the way, Thorpe's native name. So again, he was Jacobus Franciscus Thorpe on the Roman Catholic side. Now, when you're Roman Catholic. Yeah.
I heard it when you first said it, and I was like, resist.
Yeah, now, and Thorpe had ancestral lineage to Chief Blackhawk. So, I mean, he was, he's from a proud part of the of that whole nation. So,
it's true. And now, so he's got that long name from the Roman Catholic. Now, when you're Roman Catholic, you get a confirmation name. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. Now, Mark, what was your confirmation name?
Carlo. I wasn't after a saint. I was after my grandfather, and the priest let it go because he knows my grandmother. He didn't want no problems.
I just pictured you had orange sunglasses on when you were getting your confirmation. Like, Carlo.
Were you there? White suit. Cigarette extender.
It's either Carlo or the chicken man. You tell me what it's going to be. So, and Lawrence Patrick, yours was Tina, you said, right?
Yeah. What was yours then?
What was it?
Ike and Tina. No, no. No, it was John. John really went out there, you know.
Oof, yeah.
Mine was
completely unusual.
Was it?
Big Bird.
Well, now, so Thorpe's got all that nonsense going on, and then also he has a native name, because even though the Native American ancestry is both on his it's not his father's, you know, religion, if you will, because both his parents are Catholic. But on obviously the Native sides, the tradition still has to live. So Thorpe's native name was, and I'm going to screw this up, anyone who speaks Sac and Fox Nation, who, by the way, spoke Algonquin, I found out, which I thought was interesting.
Right.
Algonquins were like the Anglo-Saxons of the Native American tribes. They're a very, very sophisticated crew. Wathohuk, which loosely translate to Kahuna, just do it. No, it means bright path.
Oh, when I was doing some research, it said it translated to light after the storm or light after the lightning.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about this too, because the problem is that you're taking a language that is not English is one of the Romance languages, right? So they're all there's certain things they're going to be familiar with from French to Spanish and then Spanish to Italian. You know, these languages are playing by this is a Tower of Babel type situation here. We're trying to say what the Sac and Fox Nation is interpreting the Algonquin language to be, then reiterated to us in English that we have something to call it. So
yeah, and it
we probably screwed up a lot of
and
it.
And it might have gone through the French too, because it was the French explorers who really first came upon the Fox and Sac Nation. So mm-hmm. Are we taking a French interpretation of the Algonquin language and then translating that from the French to the English? It's kind of like locally here in Jersey, it was a Lenape. And a lot of the Lenape language was first interpreted by Dutch and German. So there's a lot of guttural pronunciations.
Cross-contamination.
Yeah.
That's a good way to word it, too. It's like the world's worst game of telephone.
Right. There you go.
Oh, my God. That's better. That's 100% better.
But just having these two names, too, I think it's an interesting point, too, because at that time period, it was the Native Americans were kind of being forced to become into white society, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So although Roman Catholicism might have been their declared religion, they were still holding on to some of their ancestral beliefs.
Oh,
and,
totally.
And
you're
going
to go to church
else.
And you're going to like it.
Right. Right. And we'll talk about more of that down the road, too. It's not just church or their religion. But
oh, it gets involved, man.
Yeah.
Now, Mark, you were right, too, by the way, that whole the Sac and Fox tradition dictates naming the child after an event that happened near its birth. So meaning that I'm an adopted kid, so my Sac and Fox name would be like, oh, shit, I'm late. What would your real quick? What would your kids? Because you got two great kids, man. What would your kids' Sac and Fox names be?
The older one would be. Should we listen to Cat Stevens when we go in? And the younger one would be, oops.
Well played. Well, now, despite these native traditions that are being observed in Thorpe's life, like my dad was saying, now both of his parents are Roman Catholic, like we said, he's going to maintain that that faith throughout his life, if you will. However, Thorpe attends an Indian agency school with his twin brother Charlie until his brother sadly dies of pneumonia at age 9. Dad, what are Indian agency schools, and do they sound like as much fun as they seem?
Yeah, it was pretty much forced education in the white man's ways that little kids as early as 5 and 6 year olds would be wipe out whatever their Indian culture or their Native American culture might be, and we're going to teach you the ways of the white man that we can better assimilate you into modern society, and you know everything that you might have picked up from your ancestors or grandparents or parents that...
They're also taking them away from the parents? Or
yeah.
Like,
it's a boarding school.
It's
type.
A boarding
now,
school.
It's not to sever a connection. It's to reinforce the teachings of the school kind of a thing.
Okay.
So now there's stricter ones and there's less strict ones. So, real quick, I just want to just frame this one part up here. So he gets he actually runs away from school several times. Then he gets sent to a full-on boarding school by his father. And his mother passes away. She passes away that there's going to be a younger sibling, and she passes away from complications due to childbirth from that. So now Jim just lost his brother, his twin brother, not for nothing. And then his mother's
like
gone.
An Elvis situation, too. Like, he holds on to it his whole life. And
oh, it's...
his brother, yeah.
Because his brother's the one who was helping him in school. His brother was sharp. And Jim, by all accounts, was not... a sharp guy. We're going to show what his skill set was later, but he was not a sharp guy, and then he was also very shy and kind of did not enjoy the spotlight. So we're talking about a guy who goes on to be the greatest, because there's an arrogance that comes with being an athlete in the modern day and age, but there's also like...
They did not get it from Jim Thorpe.
Yeah.
It's the opposite.
It's almost
right.
Like an Eli Manning thing where it's like, okay, so, you know, I understand you guys are all chanting my name right now, and that's very nice of you, but I really just want to go home.
There was somebody he went to school with that was saying his big fear was embarrassing other people because he was so superior to the other athletes. That he would actually slow down sometimes to not beat him so badly.
Right.
Which you've done that before, too, because I've seen you, because Mark's a very talented comic, and there's a lot of times where he'll sit there and be like, you know what, I'm not going to go as hard as I can tonight because Ken Kranz is on the lineup and I don't want him to kill himself.
Oh, my God.
Takes pity on the...
Our buddy Ken Kranz. On one of the funniest joke writers around, but nobody is more fun to punch in the stomach than Ken Kranz. So, now, by the way... his relationship with his father actually starts to deteriorate because he gets super depressed after his mom dies. Why wouldn't you? I totally get that. Jim runs off to work on a horse ranch, and he's age 16 at the time. So this is a wild kid here. But in 1904, he returns to his father, and the two agree that Jim is now going to attend the prestigious Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. So.
Yeah, I've been to Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
No shit. What's it like out there?
Hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Well, dude, if you want to talk about a tough school, because you were saying taking the kids away from the parents, kahuna, not only are you getting a boarding school now, it's run by a general, all right?
And it was described as prison cells.
Yeah, it was a total mind erase of all things Native American.
Did you get the motto?
Like that. So now you're taking... You're taking kids, and again, even with this, the big thing about the Carlisle School was that it was the first Indian school off the reservation, and it wasn't funded by the Indian affairs or anything. It was federally funded.
And but it was a long way from Oklahoma now too.
And it was previously an army camp. I mean, the school was originally set up in a barracks.
Very much.
And it was set up by a guy, Army Lieutenant Richard Henry Pratt. So Pratt was the guy that was, you know.
They were just like, the kids are coming. We'll keep it. It's fine.
Again, it's to the times, you know, we're not too far away from the attitude that the only good Indian was a dead Indian.
Like you said earlier,
and nits make lice kind of a thing. So, you know, when in doubt, kill them all type of a thing.
We have ways to make you white.
right. And to that, I mean.
Good God.
I just picture them slapping hot sauce out of their hands all the time. Stop it. It's too spicy.
Yes, I mean, when they went away to these boarding schools, or at least to the Carlisle school, your hair was cut, which to the Native Americans, you're not cutting the hair. I mean, that was
the sign of manhood.
Right,
that was part of the hair, right? You know, I get a lot of compliments on my hair.
I spent a lot of time on this.
But anything that was remotely Native American was to be eradicated.
Did you get the motto of that school, Dad?
I think if this is correct,
hit me.
Kill the Indian, save the man.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's General Pratt's idea. We have to kill these Indians so that we can. Now, not for nothing. That is exactly what
killed their spirit.
My chief in a Navy boot camp, Craig Plummer, who I'm very happy to still be good friends with, and I got to see him and perform. He was in the crowd down at Side Splitters with me, and it was wild because he's telling me, he goes, "You understand?" He goes, "I'm a really nice guy." He goes, "But I can't be nice to you in boot camp because we got to grow you kids up quick. Otherwise, when you get to the fleet, you'll die." And I was like, "Oh, okay, that's correct. Yeah, that's why you got to be a hard ass with us."
Right.
But so Pratt, in his mind, it sounds like it's totally brutal, and that's the exact quote, by the way, Mark. You nailed it. But yeah, so it sounds evil. But in his mind, he's like, this is the only way these kids are going to have any chance at a life. Because otherwise, they're running around in hide skins, and the Indian territory is dwindling. And I can tell you now, if you stayed on the reservations, not exactly a great place
to be.
There's
not a whole lot of advancement when you're living on the reservation.
Yeah, it's depressing out there. It's like Ken Kranz's comedy calendar.
Oh, my God.
You guys keep throwing personal barbs out there. I don't know. Can't we all just get along?
According to history, no.
if you think like times are harsh now, though, imagine being a Native American walking through a city. They really wouldn't care if you took a shot at them. You know,
and it's weird too because there's a disconnect where out in Oklahoma, there's and my father had to point this out to me one time. My fascination with the Native Americans is because I never grew up afraid of them. Now, imagine you are out in Oklahoma, and there's still the theory that, you know, a renegade Indians could come in, break in at night, and you could have, you know, they stole your sister, and you got to go on a cross-country journey to try to find her now, like John Wayne and the Searchers. But my fascination with them is because I never feared them, because growing up in New Jersey, it was pretty much all settled at that point. They were pushed far, but they were on the other side of the Mississippi mostly by that point.
And it was the 80s.
Yeah. So, but not for nothing, like around this time frame, out in Pennsylvania, there's got to be more of a curiosity about the natives than there is of that sense of a threat there, too. So there's almost a... it's almost like a freak show element, maybe, a little bit, Dad?
Yeah, there was a... yeah, I guess a freak show would be one way of describing it too. But and the whole social standing, if you will. I mean, Indian is below black. I mean, you're that in the pecking order of things. That you're
almost animal.
It's the dirty redskin. They're lazy. They're drunks. You know, they're stupid. There's all different kind of classifications put into that. Because there's a total cultural clash here that nobody, you know, the white society doesn't want to understand the native ways. We beat those guys. We defeated those guys. We, you know, now that we put them on reservations, now it's good to go for the rest of white society to build this nation into bigger and better than
And I guess at the Carlisle School, one of their big things was is having them assimilate to live with a white family. So it was almost like having a pet Native American. Like, that's how they treated it.
What was the redheaded cousin's name on
this
the Brady
Bunch? The red-skinned cousin.
Red-skinned cousin.
There you go.
We're getting complaints.
Yeah, but you're right, Mark.
One.
I mean, that whole school, the philosophy was not only to educate, but also to then teach them a trade or a skill that they could go out into white society and earn a living. And they had programs where the kids were shipped out for, like, summer work and that type of a thing with neighboring farms or whatever. And then I do have a Jersey connection there somewhere along the line. But we'll get to that.
You flagged me down when you hit that one. Okay. I did not get one here. All right. But despite all this bad shit over at the Carlisle Indian School, it winds up becoming one of the more positive influences on Jim Thorpe's life. Because get this, he winds up catching the eye of a man who is creating a premier football club over at Carlisle. It's where his athletic abilities began to get noticed. Your kids aren't old enough to play football yet, right, Mark?
Not yet.
Okay. Now, when they do, is there a name of a program or something like that they might get involved in?
Oh, Pop Warner.
You know it. Pop Warner himself is coaching over here and putting together this premier football league over at the Carlisle Indian School. Warner is a legend in the game, by the way. Coons, I know you're not a big football guy, right?
No, yeah, I was sitting here like, Pop Warner is actually the name of a person?
Yep, actually
I played Pop Warner football. Jim Thorpe played for Pop Warner.
Yeah. Well, I was saying, too, because you're the only one who played any you played in high school and college, too?
I ended up not playing in
college. I was
going to
say, I think you went to a dramatic arts school in college, so they didn't have a football team.
Horrible football team. A lot of cheerleaders, though.
Well, Pop Warner, what a legend in the game. His name, people just, is synonymous with football. But then also, I didn't realize this, he created not only the three-point stance, so the actual three-point stance in football that, you know, is pretty much the ebb and flow of the entire game. He also created the shotgun formation.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that one either. So every time Peyton Manning, pretty much 90% of Peyton Manning's touchdowns came from the shotgun formation, I think somebody told me. But he noticed right away, this Pop Warner fella, that Jim's got a little athletic ability to him, Mark. He's going to spend a little time coaching him, all right? But Jim's tragedies are continuing to mount. He now finds himself completely orphaned. His father passes away from a hunting accident, okay?
While he's at Carlisle.
Right.
So his mother only died a couple of years before that, so he is now, he's an orphan.
Jim's got a little bit of nothing.
Yeah, so his twin brother dies at the age of 8 or 9, and then his mother died shortly after that.
With childbirth count, so another sibling presumably would have been on the way.
I'm sensing a superhero origin story here, man.
It's not far off, dude. Yeah.
We got Pop Warner and Nick Fury over here recruiting for the Avengers.
I'm here to talk to you.
Never mind if
that's really good
or anything, right?
Yeah, no.
Pop Warner's not in a wheelchair just yet. Pop Warner was something special too, though. I mean, he's a Hall of Famer.
Talk to me.
Yeah, well, he's a Hall of Famer. Like you said, he originally developed the single and double wing, the spread and the shotgun formation, the three-point stance, body blocking, trap run, the bootleg, the naked reverse, the screen pass. He was the first guy to really came up with the team to go into a huddle before the next play. That's all.
He's kind of the godfather of football, really.
Yeah, really.
Essentially, yeah.
Really.
You know, I'm not going to lie. I looked up his name, and I was expecting, like, just some eccentric dude with, like, a crazy-looking mustache. No. My expectations have been lowered. Like, I'm a little disappointed. But
he looks like a football coach.
Yeah, exactly.
Really,
like, he sets the stereotype. Right. I'm just like, wait, no.
Squared jaw, and he's
box head.
He's all about it.
You know, he does kind of look like a Flintstone.
He might have a tie on, but you know he has those nut hugger pants on underneath.
You ain't wrong.
And just for rounding out, he was also involved with the spiral pass and the spiral punt. So, I mean, he developed a few new things to the whole game of football. And back then, too, now football is really in its infancy, and it was started at the collegiate level. Really before the pros got involved.
It was much bigger at the collegiate level than it was because pro football
big.
Didn't take off, oddly enough, until the greatest game ever played.
Right.
You know who played in that game, Mark?
I do not.
Greatest game ever played was...
I was going to tell you it was Brookfield High School versus Champion High School, but...
It wasn't?
But you guys, you know, might not have been there.
It was... this is why I know this one, is because the greatest game ever played was the first game that caught, on a pro level, that caught the nation's attention, because college was way more popular. But it was the Baltimore Colts versus the New York Football Giants, Dad.
Oh, all right, boy.
1925, Giants way, new head coach. This episode, by the way, Mark, just to let you know, Once we realized the tie-in with Pop Warner and a couple of the other wild stories about Thorpe we're about to get to, that's why this episode is coming out the week of the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So we're going to sit on this one for 2 weeks here.
And the reason I'm a guest, I was born in Canton, Ohio, which where the Hall of Fame is, which is
why I know you were born in Canton.
Yeah, which is why I know who Jim Thorpe is, because he's everywhere.
I'll delete this part of the episode. Jesus. You're supposed to know.
No, because we always call him the Prince of Youngstown.
We moved when I was in junior high.
There you go. But
so you could play in that world famous football game as a high school kid.
I had to be in the greatest game played.
Had to call you in.
Do you have anything else on Pop Warner before we move on, sir?
Well, I'll have a little something for him later on. Maybe. But Pop Warner,
he doesn't go away. He's still in the story.
Yeah,
for a while.
He coached more than just at the Carlisle Indian School. He was all over and all the big names.
I do have a question though. With the way that you've been talking about Jim, though, building up, like, is he just a football? Like, does he just play football? Because you said athlete.
He doesn't play anything yet.
He doesn't play anything.
Yeah, he's just getting noticed.
Okay.
This is like a standout in gym class kind of
thing. He's discovered while at the Carlisle Indian School.
So I'll tell you what, if you're okay with it, LP, and you reel me back in if you need to, but I want to hit, while we have Kahuna peaked right now with his attention here, because not that you tune out, but it did make me laugh, by the way. He brought up Pop Warner to look at a picture of him. If you guys saw his previous Google search, it was Fox and Socks.
Because every time you said it, I was just like, should I make a joke out of it? No.
He's trying to make a little hand puppet out of his sock. That's all.
I was like, the Dr. Seuss Nation. No, shut up, Christian.
But I thought we're just going to give him the superhero moment here to set this thing up. So
he was bit by a radioactive spider.
He was kicked in the face by a radioactive football.
That's now imagine that one, man. Oh, dude. But he winds up catching the eye of Pop Warner, like we said. Now, and he's orphaned here. Things are bad right now. It's a sad time to be Jim Thorpe. Except this is the part where the story starts to read less like history and more like an Avengers movie, as Kahuna said.
Mm-hmm.
Cahoon's in 1907, after returning to Carlisle. Jim walked past the high school the school high jumpers. Okay.
Yeah, the track team is out practicing.
The track team's out practicing. Jim Thorpe walks around and hits an impromptu 5'9" jump. How tall are you, Kahuna?
I'm 6'4".
You're 6'4". I am 5'9". Realize that this guy just walked up and just did. He could clear my head.
The kids on the track team couldn't make the jump, and he just kind of went over and
that looks
gave
like
him a free
fun
lesson.
Yeah, he's walking by, and he's watching these guys at practice.
In his dress shoes.
And then they kind of, you want to give it a try? So he's in street clothes. In street clothes.
Gigantor.
Without warm-ups or anything else, and just you know, runs up and clears it.
Do you picture the million-dollar man sound while he's coming through here?
How tall is he? Varying reports, but I'm putting it at about 6'1" about 195.
I complain when I have to go to the basement to get the laundry and I'm wearing jeans. This guy in full dress gear.
Yeah.
School clothes.
Street clothes, and he's clearing it.
So with ease he's doing
this. Yeah, with ease, without even trying hard. And then the next day, Jim Thorpe is called into Coach Warner, Pop Warner's office. And he's thinking, oh, shit, I'm in trouble because interrupting the – and Pop Warner is also the football coach, but he's also the track coach as well. Mm-hmm. So, obviously,
the kids
were practicing let the coach know that, hey, we this kid just cleared 5'9". So he's called into Pop Warner's office, and – initially, Jim Thorpe is thinking, oh, shit, I'm in trouble because I was interrupting his practice. And Pop Warner was pretty much an authoritarian, that you were going to do it his way.
You get called down to his office, right. You're screwed.
So if you're called into the office, you're on the carpet. You're screwed. But Pop Warner lets him know that you just broke the school record yesterday at 5'9".
And Jim Thorpe was such a bashful guy. He goes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right. What do I do?
Right.
But
so with that, he is immediately put on the Carlisle Indian School track team and starts breaking all kinds of records.
Well, not just track, too.
He starts with track, and he's like a superstar in track, winning all kinds of medals in various competitions with other schools. And then he comes out for the football team initially.
And Pop didn't want him to play, right?
Yeah, and Pop didn't want him to play football because he was afraid that he was going to get hurt. Yep. And ruin his track career.
Got to get hit to get hurt, coach.
Yeah, but then just constantly being in Pop. Come on, let me try this. Let me try that. He starts, I think, as a kicker, and he at that time you could drop kick for a three pointer, right?
Correct.
For a field goal, you could drop kick the ball for a field goal. So he's drop kicking 50-yard field goals,
which is impressive now.
Yes,
right. I mean, I read reports where he would come out like before games and stand at the 50-yard line and drop kick one over the one end zone and turn around and face the other way and drop kick one over the other end zone.
Intimidation move.
Right.
Now, before we go full on to his football stuff, because the football stuff's amazing, but I do want to make sure that we get this one weird little asterisk on his career. You played football in high school, right, Mark? Any other sports?
I wrestled and played baseball.
I wrestled and I played lacrosse.
I got kicked off the baseball team.
That's steroids.
That's it. Yes, yes. It had nothing to do with me having walkie-talkies in the outfield.
You weren't stealing signs back in the day?
That was on the football team.
Another episode of American Loser will be coming your way to cover that one soon. But Thorpe's athletic career is taking off here. He soon dominates on campus in track, baseball, football, lacrosse, and ballroom dancing.
Yes.
He literally wins the intercollegiate championship in 1912.
We had a kid like this in high school, my buddy Steve Wiley, who colleges were looking at every sport he played. He was a world amazing pitcher. He was our kicker and our linebacker.
Jesus.
And he was a killer. And he also was a really great wrestler that colleges were looking at for that. He was like our Jim Thorpe. He was like a man playing with children.
it really does start to feel that way. Now, what'd you have for the football? Because his football career is insane. The collegiate, because in here we're talking about playing multiple positions, Dad?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, to put the listeners in the proper mindset, this is early football where you didn't have squads, you didn't have offense, defense. You had, in 1911 and 1912, the Carlisle football team consisted of 11 or 12 guys. Mm-hmm. So you had 11 or 12 guys out on the field that were playing both ways. Right.
Yeah.
They were playing offense and defense. And they were killing it. And they weren't just taking on any slouch teams. They were taking on some major competition, like West Point. I've got the list here somewhere.
Do you have the list of positions he played, too? I thought that was kind of worth noting.
Pretty much everything. It was kind of like that Warner Brothers cartoon with Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny first base, Bugs Bunny second base, Bugs Bunny pitcher.
Running back, Jim Thorpe. Defensive back, Jim Thorpe. Place kicker, Jim Thorpe. And punt by Jim Thorpe.
There you go.
I would score every point.
Yes.
Made in the game.
Because if he scored the touchdown, he would then kick the point after, or if they settle for a field goal, guess who's kicking the field goal? There was one in that one season where the team finished 11-1, Thorpe is estimated to have scored. And this is from a correction, because there were other, like, original stats weren't kept as well as they could have been back then. Thorpe is estimated to have scored 224 points and 27 touchdowns for his team.
Yeah.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah. The four seasons that Thorpe played for the Carlisle Indians, that was their That was their mascot. Mm-hmm. Who figured, right? The Carl Lundin School was taking on the Indians.
They were going to be the Vikings, but they had a problem with it.
They won, in the 4 years, they won 43 games, lost five, and tied two. And the first seven games of 1912, which was Jim Thorpe's final year, Carlisle outscored its opponents 272-15.
Oh, wow.
They crushed. They crushed. And they weren't playing any slouch schedules either. They were playing Army, Penn, Harvard, Syracuse.
This is back when Harvard was good. Harvard had one of the first programs.
Early on, right?
Yeah.
Syracuse, Pitt, Minnesota, and Nebraska. And most of their games was played on the road because the Carlisle Indian School Stadium couldn't handle the crowds. So, I mean, they were making a big national splash in all the media.
And they were called the Indians because it was to play up the savagery that the hometown boys are going to defend us from an Indian attack, kind of a thing. Now, from that team did finish 11-1, like you said, Dad. And now in this game again, they beat Harvard that year, which is like unheard of at the time.
Yeah. Right, that was huge. That was huge.
The one I want to talk about is the game against Army.
Yeah, well, they scored one of the biggest upsets, if you will, with Harvard, but then they went on to. And the upset with Harvard was like 18-15 upset before 25,000 people in Cambridge. So that was
a big deal.
That was huge for 1912. But now they're going to go against Army, right? West Point. And before the Army game, again going back to Pop Warner, I found this and I thought this was pretty incredible too, that on November 9th, Carlisle was to meet the U.S. Military Academy in a game at West Point. So, again, they're on the road, right? They were now considered the two top teams in the country, Army and the Carlisle Indians. And Pop Warner spoke to the team before the game, and I have a quote. "Your fathers and your grandfathers," Warner began, "are the ones who fought their fathers. These men playing against you today are soldiers. They are the long knives. You are Indians. Tonight, we will know if you are warriors." That dramatic evening, Carlisle routed Army 27-6. That game played just 22 years after the last Army battle with the Lakota Sioux at Wounded Knee.
Oh, my God.
So,
I don't know about you, KP. I'm ready to go play.
Remember the Titans can wipe their ass with that speech.
These college-age Indian kids, it's now only 22 years since the Army was slaughtering people at Wounded Knee. But now, hey, it's 11 guys on a field and 11 guys.
Their parents and grandparents.
Within the lifetimes of a lot of the people who are in attendance at the game now. So a simulated version. It's almost like in Gladiator when they had the gladiators acting out the great battles from Rome's history, but a little bit more civil of a version of that.
Well, it's if we played Iraq in soccer.
I can't wait.
Or the Miracle on Ice when we played the Soviets in the Olympics.
Which
right?
We always say on the show, don't fuck with TR, but if the Russians learned anything, it's don't fuck with Kurt Russell.
Yeah, and this is right in TR's time frame, too, because he was asked as president to let's start setting some rules for some of these collegiate football games because people were getting killed in college football.
I wonder if he flipped the coin. TR's out there to flip the coin before the game.
Well, he had his – because remember the Native American Chiefs actually marched down Pennsylvania Avenue for his inauguration. There was the four chiefs were coming in for TR's inauguration, and Geronimo was one of them. And then Geronimo was he thought he was going to finally get a chance to plead his case to TR, and TR goes, "You were bad Indians. You killed many white men." But little side note we just have to hit here before we move on from this ridiculous game against Army. In this game, Jim Thorpe ran for a 92-yard touchdown. One play, 92-yard touchdown. All right? That's incredible by today's standards.
And who is on the defense on that?
Well, get before we even hit to that one, Mark, because I'm going to let you say who it is because it's exciting. But that 92-yard touchdown is negated by a penalty by his teammate. All right? So what does Jim Thorpe turn around and do? Next play, he runs for a 97-yard touchdown. Okay, so I'll take that 5-yard penalty you just hit me with, and I'll do it again. Ram it right down your throat. And Mark Riccadonna, what future president of the United States is trying to play defense against this guy?
Mr. Eisenhower.
President Dwight D. Eisenhower. And he literally recalled it years later. He goes, like you said, Mark, it was the way that Eisenhower talked about him, it was a man playing with children. You know, God was on the field that day. Or the great Larry Bird quote about Michael Jordan. That's not Michael Jordan. That's God disguised as Michael Jordan. So, but 1912 is a wild, wild place in the world, Dad. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, 1912, again, to put the listeners in that right mindset, 1912, that's the year that the Titanic sank. Right? Taft is your president. New Mexico becomes the 47th state. So a lot of these Indian territories aren't even states yet. New Mexico, Arizona, I think, was before Hawaii and Alaska. So even Arizona, Oklahoma became a state right around that same time period. Oklahoma became a state in 1907. So we're within... You know, within a 10 or a decade time period, one of our previous episodes was Pancho Villa. Pancho is riding around the Southwest causing all kinds of problems. We got Black Jack Pershing going into Mexico to hunt down Pancho Villa. So, yeah, it's a wild and woolly kind of a thing. The first train... You think about this. So we travel, getting ready to go to Florida. The first train arrives in Key West, Florida in 1912.
So, and Joe Conte was on it.
There you go. In 1912, as I say, Taft is the president. But we got a minor Jersey tie in here, though, because in the summer of that, of 1912, Woodrow Wilson, who was at the time the New Jersey governor, is nominated to run for president for his party. So these are wild and woolly times. This is right before World War One starts, and World War One starts in 1914. We're talking 1912. So things are getting, you know, starting to boil in Europe.
Now I'm going to quiz you real quick,
okay,
to see if you remember this one. Let's see if he remembers this piece of trivia. And if any of you guys know it too, please hop in. But you want to take a guess when Woodrow Wilson is going to be made president. You want to guess who his Secretary of State was?
I'm going to say T.R. just because we were talking about him.
No, it is T.R.'s nemesis of sorts, William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah. Another Italian. Mm-hmm.
So, and we're only 7 years away from Shoeless Joe Jackson getting in trouble.
He comes into play a little bit later because his team, he's not on the team yet. I checked the rosters last night. I was really hoping for that tie-in. I'm not going to lie. But the 1912 world is pretty odd on that one. Now, LP, were you finished on that one? I don't want to cut you off.
No, that's good. That's, you know, I'm just trying to...
Very passive-aggressive there. I'm sorry I cut you off.
So 1912 was just the epicenter of loserception, kind
of,
almost?
It is.
Well, there's
wait
a lot
till
of,
you see some of the other shit we found.
This is the Magnolia moment.
Quality reference. 1912's world is a wild, wild place. Thorpe loves football, but he's focusing his efforts on preparing for a thing... Now, a year before this, he didn't understand what they were, but Pop Warner tells him about these this series of games and events set up by the Greeks many centuries ago called what, Dad?
The Olympics. I mean, Jim Thorpe had no idea what the Olympics were. It wasn't until it was explained to him by Pop Warner, and Pop Warner tells him, well, it's all these countries around the world are sending their best athletes to compete in Sweden. And Thorpe is like, oh, shit, if we're putting the best against the best. I mean, that was his great opportunity to prove himself, not only for his own personal thing, but to prove his Indian heritage, if you will.
Now, he was not a simple
American
man.
I keep saying Native American,
okay,
but
we're
at the time, you're an Indian.
Yeah.
You're not a Native American. That wasn't politically correct.
Actual Indians are still in India at this time.
Right.
So we didn't have to have the delineation there. But
North American Indians.
Correct. Or as well, it's the great Mark Riccadonna joke, having a an Indian landlord. You are not my buddy, buddy. But no, he loves. I don't want to paint him as simple. Okay, he's definitely not a sophisticated guy here, and he's a bashful guy. He's a good soul. You can tell. There's a little Forrest Gump to him almost in this way, when it's like Pop Warner's like, hey, you want to go participate in the Olympics? Well, sure, coach. I'll go over there.
Yeah.
Want to meet the president? Sure.
More on that later.
What?
He breaks the shot put record. Just throw that rock, okay?
Yeah, right.
New record.
Well,
Get me the ball.
Thorpe loves football, but he focuses his efforts on preparing for the Olympics now. And interestingly enough, his ability with jumps, hurdles, high jumps, shot put, and pole vaulting earns him a trip to Sweden to represent the nation. That's not bad for a boy from a Native American boarding school.
Right.
All right?
Right.
So, now this was taken from...
Born in Native American country.
Indeed. So, there you go. He'll represent a country you didn't know existed.
Indian territory.
Yeah, on a global scale, man. But this was taken from his obituary. I thought this was worth noting. His obituary in the New York Times. Thorpe could run the 100-yard dash in 10 seconds flat, the 220 in 21.8 seconds, the 440 in 51.8 seconds, the 880 in a minute 57, and the mile in 435. I don't want to tell you what I qualified to join the United States military with. It was two of that.
My Impala barely does that.
But he could pole vault 11 feet, and he could put the shot 47 feet and 9 inches. He could throw the javelin 163 feet, throw the disc at 136 feet, and he was a master impressionist.
And a ballroom dancer.
Well, he was a one-man army at the for the decathlon and the pentathlon, it was called. Now, get this little thing we got to just tie in here. He's in Sweden now, okay, and he's participating in the Olympics. And as we said, there's a world war kind of...
brewing.
Well, brewing, and then the United States certainly doesn't get involved until much later. But so Jim Thorpe is over here, and he does very well for himself. Now, you want to talk about a weird twist of events. He finishes first in 8 out of 15 of his events. The events that he did not, like, really dominate in, it was because it was his first time ever doing them.
That was javelin, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine the first time you're doing it, it's for a gold medal.
Right. And I had read, too, that the first time he threw the javelin, he didn't know that you could run an end throw. So he's standing flat-footed and throwing the thing and placed third.
So there really
he's
is
from the future, too.
Yes.
Because when you see his build...
Third place!
You see his build compared to the other athletes in the Olympics, and you're like, oh, those are old-timey athletes. This guy's a modern-day athlete. Like, he was built like a modern-day athlete. He's a monster.
Freakish. It's literally freakish. And
I love that image of him just standing there, just chucking
I throw spear far.
Well, yeah. Now here's the wildest one. Again, this is a simple. This is his own reference of himself. Is that he often talks about himself in some of his writings and speeches as a simple Indian boy. That's what he calls himself. All right, so we're not making anything up here. There's no pejorative attached to it. And if you're listening to this and you have a blog and you want to destroy my career, I want to remind you, my name is Ken Krantz.
Too, for the times, there was no weight training in the off season, and trainers in the locker room and everything.
Diets.
The equipment. You're talking about the leatherhead, helmet days. There wasn't even face masks. You just go out there and just beat the shit out of the other guy, or try to.
Natural ability.
And
Eisenhower called him gifted from God.
A gift from God. Mm-hmm. And this is his physique or his build. You were saying it's different than everybody else's. It was really just from hard work, from getting out there and doing hard manual labor.
Yeah, I don't think there was cotton candy machines at the Carlisle Indian School either.
And going back to what we said, that they were in school, but then they went out into the community to work for the community. And that's where I have a very loose New Jersey tie-in.
Uh-oh.
That while he was...
I have a loserception in a minute, too.
At the time, there were 1,000 students at the Carlisle School from varying ages, from like 10 to 25. So there's a big swath of kids. And you've got to remember, they're pulled off their various reservations, taken away from mom and dad, shipped off to this place called Pennsylvania. You know, it's probably the first time that they were ever more than 20 miles off their homeland, their reservation, or Indian territory. They spent half the day in the classroom reading and writing, and the other half they were in a shop learning a trade. Thorpe's training was in tailoring. And then, like many of the students, he went out to live and work with white families that were in the area. He spent 2 years on a farm in our own Robinsonville, New Jersey, tending to livestock and earning a whopping $8 a month, working for a guy by the name of Harvey Rosarth. That he worked for this guy like for 2 summers. So anyway, he's out there lifting the load and doing
breaking horses more than
Taylor, and he's doing more cattle ranching like used to do back home in Oklahoma.
I thought you were going to say that he worked at a little convenience store in Leonard, New Jersey. I'm not even supposed to be here today.
No, but that was our. He worked in New Jersey summers while he was in the Carlisle School, which
that's
helped
wild.
Him kept him pretty physical, pretty good physical shape.
Now we're not going to fast forward. We're not going to skip over any details here. We are going to pick the pace up real quick though, because we do have somewhere to be.
All right.
But real quickly, he wins 2 gold medals and 2 challenge prizes. And he sets an Olympic points record that would stand for nearly 2 decades. All right, so now Jim Thorpe, the simple Indian boy from Oklahoma, is being awarded medals and prizes by King Gustav of Sweden, okay, and Tsar Nicholas of Russia, the last of the Romanovs. So you want to talk about something weird here, too? You want loserception? Obviously, the Romanovs, there's a whole, you know, Rasputin gets involved around this time frame and the fall of the Russian monarchy.
Right.
Very, very sad story. But guess who is also involved in the Olympics, Kahuna, that is winning gold medals in shooting, but has a little controversy going on right now? He's making the face.
Yeah, he's making the face.
Yep. Future General George Patton is participating in the same Olympic team.
1912.
Kahuna has left the building. Thank you, and good afternoon.
So
say goodnight, Gracie.
Yeah, it is wild. Now, by the way, that that gold medal that he won in the track event, Dad, a little weird caveat with that, is there not? Mark,
yeah.
Do you know the story?
Mm-mm.
Oh, man. Okay. Larry found a good one.
He was awarded medals and prizes by King Gustav for the pentathlon and the decathlon.
Right.
So it was 5 events and then 10, followed by 10 events. He's just crushing the whole thing. But when he was going out to run for the, which eventually he would win 2 gold medals for, someone had stolen his shoes, his track
I
shoes.
I have heard this story.
It's not. It shouldn't be real.
So now, is this, you know, somebody just breaking chops because he's the dumb Indian from America? At this time, he's not even considered a U.S. citizen because
they
Indians,
don't get it till 1924.
Native Americans, did not be granted U.S. citizenship until 1924. So he's just an American Indian.
They were going to build a wall, but they didn't know where to put it.
So he goes to run in the event, and somebody stole his shoes. So is this an act of prejudice or what's going on? So he goes rummaging around in the trash and finds two mismatched shoes.
Yeah, they weren't the same.
They weren't even a matched pair. It was a left and a right, and one shoe was much too big for him, so he's wearing like 3 or 4 pairs of socks.
Mama said these was my magic shoes.
Yeah.
So, apparently wasn't even mad about it.
Is he facing racial calm prejudice guy. Here with somebody stealing his shoes? Hey, what the hell? You know, I've always done without. So let me just rummage around and see what I can come up with. He puts on these 2 mismatched shoes, one with like 4 pairs of socks, one with, the normal, and damn if he doesn't win the gold medal running in throwaway shoes.
So that is insane. Now, he comes back. On his return to the U.S., Thorpe receives a ticker tape parade down Broadway. And I think the line was, so many people in the crowd were shouting his name. He goes, I never knew a fella could have so many friends. So he's staying as – there's an Eli Manning quality to him. There's a Forrest Gump innocence. There's just – this guy's very easy to root for.
Yeah, even when King Gustav of Sweden – now here he is.
That got debunked.
He's a – what, did he just said thanks?
Yeah, thanks, King.
Oh, thanks, King.
Yeah, that got debunked. There, okay, there was a rumor. Right. I was so excited to tell that one, and then it got debunked because they were saying that he was such a shy guy, there's no way he would have said anything like that. But he was aloof. He didn't know that he's talking to royalty. He didn't understand royalty, you know?
Right.
He just kind of shoot the shit with anybody, like if there was anybody.
He was a man of very few words.
Which it goes to show in the rest of his life, too. Now, it starts to get sad here because this is the first time that he kind of gets... people coming down on him. But upon his return to the U.S., he winds up getting involved with the Irish American Athletes Club, which, as you guys know, is essentially just, hockey and baseball now. and John McEnroe. It's like a track athlete competition kind of thing in New York. And he shows up and just starts smoking motherfuckers. I mean, it's not even close. He's shattering records. One of the premier athletes was a guy by the name of Martin Sheridan, who was considered one of the finest athletes in the history of the United States. He was the previous record holder, and while witnessing his own record get destroyed by Jim Thorpe, he was so blown away watching the record that as soon as the race was over, Thorpe walked. And he wasn't even participating in the race; he was just watching it. And Martin Sheridan walks up, who could be, you have every right to be an asshole. My legacy is gone now. And he walks up to Thorpe and just goes, you are the finest athlete I have ever set eyes on. So he's winning people over, the hearts and minds.
He dated 6 months, too.
He went to second base that night. But unfortunately, about 6 months after the Olympics closing ceremony, Thorpe had come, starts to come under fire here a little bit. There's this big debate at the time between professionalism in the world of athletics and amateurism. And towards the end of the Olympics, Thorpe had participated in two exhibition baseball games. Okay, now, due to Thorpe admitting to having played professionally in the past, he had gotten paid in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. What you would do is in the summers off from school, a lot of the kids who were playing college ball would go and they would play professional ball in the summer.
Couple bucks.
Yeah. Literally $2 a game, $55 a game today. Okay, which, it's still not a whole
Today's
lot of money.
Today's money would be $55.
Yeah, yeah. So,
more than a comedian makes.
That's it's really sad, isn't it? The sacrifices we've made for nothing. Now, what Jim Thorpe didn't know, again, this aloofness comes into play here, is that the other kids from the colleges that were doing this, the white kids that he was palling around with and playing with, they all used fake names. Jim Thorpe didn't know you're supposed to make up a fake name. And again, he has a couple of fake names you could use, Jacobus Franciscus.
Why are you supposed to make up a fake name, though?
Because if you got paid to be an athlete, you were considered a professional athlete, and therefore you were barred from the amateur events. Like the Olympics.
Okay.
So, get this, man. They wind up, his status as an amateur gets revoked, and because of this, he is stripped of his gold medals. All right? Native Americans were not granted citizenship in the U.S., like we said, that until 1924. Race is rumored to have played a part in the stripping of Thorpe's medals, and it's a sad thing, man. It was a journalist that discovered this on accident, right, Dad?
It was a journalist that was doing a story. He was down in Rocky Mount. He's in the manager's office.
He didn't know.
He's in the manager's office in Rocky Mountain. Notices that there's a framed picture on the wall of a bunch of guys coming back from a hunting trip, and looks at the photograph. And this was supposedly innocently. He looks at it and realizes that one of the guys on this hunting trip in this photograph is none other than Jim Thorpe. Now he's recognized all over the world now because he's already won the Olympics in 1912. So this is like now in 1913. So it's more than 6 months later after this whole big fanfare, the ticker tape parade, and all that kind of thing going down Broadway. But he looks and sees Thorpe in the photograph and asks this guy, the manager, "Hey, isn't that Jim Thorpe?" He says, "Yeah, he played for us a couple of summers ago." And he was paid, like you say, $2 a game. So when that got published, when that word got out, then there was a whole big uproar, big stink, and the Olympic Committee stripped him of his awards. But there's more to that down the road also.
Oh, totally. And again, race does play an issue in it, for sure, they say. And not for nothing, the public opinion on him has not changed. This is Jim Thorpe, world's greatest athlete. How you pieces of shit taking away his medals?
Right,
like
the
that?
Popularity of, yeah. of the guy was huge. I mean, anybody that was able to do those events as he did, I mean, just blowing the opponents away. I think the second guy behind him, I'm not sure whether it was the Olympics or was it those New York Games. It was like 3,000 points behind him for second place, kind of a thing. So, I mean, he's just
a
clearly blew
second.
Him. Yeah, now, a very, very distant second.
I do have a question, though. So, this podcast is called Married Loser. I feel bad. So, like, is the loser the people that he kicked?
The loser's America.
Because, like, I don't
the
hear...
The loser's America, not
Yeah, like, that's what I'm thinking.
At that part, I would say, yeah, the loser is the people that are taking the medals away from him. Now, what winds up happening to this guy, because not for nothing, who do you think is the greatest athlete living right now, Kahuna?
I'm a poor person asked for that.
No, but you, I mean, you, can,
Kahuna,
you know,
you're looking right across the table.
He's in front of your face.
Is that Mark Riccadonna, offensive tackle for
Podunk High School?
But name an athlete off the top of your head.
Michael Jordan?
Michael Jordan. Okay. Do you think Michael Jordan is ever going to have to be working as a bouncer or a handyman or being an extra in a movie?
No.
Do you think Michael Jordan...
Well, he did Space Jam. No,
I said an extra, though.
No, yeah,
do you think Michael Jordan is ever going to have to be admitted as a charity case to a hospital to handle lip cancer?
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Just wait, buddy. Just wait. Now, it's not all bad yet, because this next little chapter of amazing shit is happening for him. So, because they publicly strip him of the gold medals, they're also publicly announcing his professionalism. Career. Okay, so he is now officially known as a professional in baseball. I'm sorry, a professional athlete, which means he can start courting offers from professional baseball teams.
Yeah, just before we jump into that, I thought it was an interesting side note, too, that it was our own Pop Warner who filled out the application for Jim to go to the 1912 Olympics, that he didn't know what the Olympics were until Pop Warner explained it to him. It was Pop who filled out all the paperwork, kind of a thing, and then disavowed any knowledge of knowing that Thorpe ever played baseball for Rocky Mount back in the day. But
yes means your enlistment stops. No means Navy opportunity. That's what the recruiter told me when I filled out the health forms before boot camp.
There you go.
Well, and apparently Jim Thorpe didn't even know the rules.
He did not
about what. He had no to be paid to play.
He had no clue what was amateur status or professional status type of a thing. As I said, he
just played to play.
Yeah, I just want to play, and he was given the opportunity to compete against the world's best athletes. He was all about that. Yeah,
which ironically, it's just like the Shoeless Joe episode, which was the one we did before, where it's this guy kind of got caught in a controversy that he didn't even know he was part of.
Yep, it's how can you have a signed confession that you don't even know how to read?
So, like, did he from the way you've described him, did he take it to heart when his medals were stripped, or like was he more like okay,
no, kind of kept it moving? That was a definite blow, absolutely.
It hurt, but it didn't stop him, because now this is where it gets kind of cool. So, his favorite sport is football. But football is not paying right now. What the America's pastime, you're kind of in a golden age, as Mark was alluding to, of baseball.
Right.
Baseball is set up to pay you a living wage. So now our boy Jim is in a very, very interesting time here, because he's technically a free agent before there were free agents. Okay? Because he's finally been announced. There's no team that owns a contract to him. There's no sorts of nonsense going on with all that. Obviously, you guys know the story about Babe Ruth being under a contract from the Boston Red Sox, and then selling that contract to the Yankees,
right.
Curse the Bambino. But because he's a free agent now, he's actually able to choose which club he's going to play for, hence the free agency. He's getting courted by clubs instead of drafted or controlled. He turns down an offer from the basement-dwelling, get the name of this team, Mark, the St. Louis Browns. What is it about that name that if your team is named the Browns, You,
it's not going to happen. That's the American loser mascot.
You have an allergic reaction to victory or success.
There you go.
Okay. Which, by the way, at the time of this podcast recording, the Cleveland Browns still do not have a head coach. They're the only team in the NFL without a head coach as of right now.
And they'll probably do better.
That's well, there's something about the name, man. He instead joins the New York Giants. All right, not my Giants, not the not Eli Manning and Strahan and the boys.
No, the baseball Giants.
Yes,
but the New York baseball Giants.
Yes, who are now known as the San Francisco Giants, who have just happened to have won the 1912 National League Championship. So they win the pennant. All right, they're going to go to the World Series. With Thorpe on the team now, the Giants win the pennant again and went on to the World Series, where they lost in 1913 in the World Series to the Philadelphia Athletics, now of Oakland. Hilarious, too, right?
But, yeah, and at the time that he signed for the Giants really didn't need a rookie outfielder.
Not at all.
Great an athlete as Thorpe was, they didn't really need another rookie outfielder. And the manager of the Giants at the time was a guy by the name of McGraw, who was nicknamed the Little Napoleon. That he was another authoritarian coach.
Just to let the listeners know about Jim Thorpe's athletic abilities, when he played at Rocky Mountain, he batted 370.
Yeah.
Like, that's
crushed.
Pretty amazing.
Crushed.
Just a simple Indian kid.
No one's hitting 370. I didn't hit 370 in T-ball. Okay, let's get that shit straight.
Swing and a miss. Oh, yeah. Kev, keep your eye on that ball.
I don't know. That T-ball's on something.
He was hired by the Giants really just as a drawing card. He was like the novelty, the ornament. Come see Jim Thorpe, you know, the Olympic champion and everything else.
Sell some tickets, and he's reliable.
That, they'll manage that.
He would have played more oddly if he had gone to the Browns, but I think he wanted to be a part of a winning organization.
Well, and he really was just hired as a box office draw, like you say.
Indeed.
But he hated riding the bench because McGraw wouldn't play him. And he hated riding the bench. And then one day, I thought this was pretty cool.
Well, McGraw has a... What record does he hold in baseball history?
Oh, I think he has the most times that a manager's been thrown out of a game.
And one time he took his hockey skate off and tried to fight a guy with it.
But one day Thorpe is actually on one of the bases and misses a sign from McGraw. McGraw calls him a dumb Indian, and apparently Thorpe had a little something to say about that, and chases McGraw through the dugout, and half the team had to restrain him from beating the shit out of McGraw. Thorpe was sold to Cincinnati the next day.
Insanity here. Now, we do have to wrap up as we're getting to the downside of the career. So I'm going to start hitting my notes hard, and I want you to you give me the high sign when you got something.
All right.
And Mark, obviously, always hop in whenever you have something, man. But I do want to get the kahuna out of here on time. And we have some venison to eat, fellas.
Screw the kahuna. It's more about the venison.
Yeah, I have not eaten today.
Oh, damn.
Oh, hurt. We're hungry, dude.
Well, now, as soon as they lose the 1913 World Series, they go on tour. All right? So now his team, the New York Giants, are going to go on tour with the Chicago White Sox, who just a few seasons later, as listeners of this very podcast would know, and Mark pointed out earlier, would throw the World Series and ruin shoeless Joe Jackson's career. All right? Say it ain't so, Joe. But this tour is a smash success, man. Ticket sales are through the roof because you got Jim Thorpe's name attached to it. All right, Thorpe, the simple Indian boy now. You talked about earlier meeting presidents and, you know, Forrest Gump and all that stuff. How about meeting the Pope?
Oh, damn.
Thorpe meets the Pope. Not bad for a Catholic boy. I'm sure his parents were very proud of him for that one. What'd you say your name was again? Wathohawk? Sorry, it's an old habit. So Thorpe meets with the Pope and other heads of state. Not the first time, okay? But he also winds up getting to play baseball in front of the King of England. All right? Pretty fucking solid resume here. Thorpe is a strong baseball player, but he's not quite the star that he was on the football field. Like you said, Daddy gets traded several times. He's often moved from the majors down to the minors, but baseball pays enough, so that's
right.
Why it's worth
baseball
his time.
Baseball pays, so there you go. So, if you got athleticism and you want to make some money off of that, you got to go with baseball at this particular point in time.
Right. And he's going to wind up playing for other clubs such as the Boston Braves. Braves moved to Atlanta. And then obviously Boston, you know, winds up getting the Red Sox too. There's a time where the Boston Brewers are involved there. They moved to Milwaukee. So sports are wild how those teams move around. The Cincinnati Reds. Okay. And then he winds up having a second stint with the Giants again. And Mark, to your point earlier, he ends his baseball career with 176 hits, 82 RBIs, and 7 home runs. That is 7 more home runs than anyone at this table has professionally.
Right. Yeah, and another point, too, is that you're also talking about these statistics during the dead ball days of baseball. In other words,
good point.
The ball is different than it is today. So to hit a home run back then, you had to knock the stuffing off it, knock the cover off the ball to get out of the park.
Well, now, he never does forget about his true love, though. All right,
well, just before you end with that, too, his career batting average while a professional baseball player was .252. So that's with over,
that's weird. That's what I weigh.
289 games. So, not you know, he wasn't the superstar in baseball that he was in track or later in football, but he certainly was no slouch either.
I agree with you on that one. Now I'm going to ask a favor of you while I get into this next little topic here, because I have to talk to Mark directly about this one. Can you text Uncle Paulie and let him know 7:45?
I can do that.
Thank you. So, now he never forgets his true love of football. So, what better way to talk about this next thing than to talk to a kid from Canton? All right, Marcus Anthony Riccadonna. He signs with a team. Did you know Canton had a football team?
Yes, of course.
What was the name of the team?
The Bulldogs.
You know it, dude. I have a Bulldog at home. I'm pretty happy about that.
And the biggest rivalry in history is the Canton Bulldogs versus the Massillon Tigers.
No shit. I didn't know that.
They play at Fawcett Stadium every year.
Oh, that's like for the tradition game kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, it's two high schools, and they're insane. Like,
that's got to be fun to see.
If you're born in Canton or Massillon...
The birthplace of football, by the way, for those that don't
know. They send you, if you're a boy, a football, and a girl, you get a pom-pom.
Perfect. Well, and he signs with the Canton Bulldogs in 1915. And get this, he was paid $250 a game. Okay, $6,000 a game today. You and me would take that in a heartbeat.
$250 then is $6,000 today. Then.
Yeah. Right. Which is ridiculous for the time.
I'll let somebody knock the shit out of me for $6,000.
But for how long?
There's right.
Yeah, we all say that.
I'm
and
good
then we
for
see,
one game.
Yeah, and then
one
you just
play.
See Lawrence Taylor just breathing heavy on the
Right.
I just let my soul leave my body at that point and be like, well.
You don't have a choice. But it's pretty wild because this massive paycheck for sports at that time, but we still look at that, and that's like peanuts compared to what these guys are making now. I think they worked out Garrett Cole's contract for whatever amount of however many $100,000 he makes per pitch with his new contract with the Yankees.
Right.
But he was good for it, all right? Thorpe was worth the money. The Bulldogs are winning titles, and attendance jumps up over 800% for his debut game.
Wow.
All right? 800%.
Yeah, I think that was throughout the season. They were pretty much sellouts throughout the season. It wasn't just his debut game, but... Yeah,
specifically for his debut game, the crowd, they sold over 800 more times.
800 times, yeah. Right.
Wow, I'm bad at math. Really?
just saying good. It, that's all.
Well, the Bulldogs wind up winning titles in 1916, 1917, and 1919. You know what happened in 1918, Mark? We don't talk about 1918.
Was there a little war going on?
No, it's just one year that Thorpe didn't win, so I'm sure he was such a fierce competitor, he wouldn't want to talk about it. Like it always makes me laugh that when Jorge Posada was getting interviewed, they asked him if he had any regrets with the Yankees, and he still complained about the 2001 World Series. And they're like, really? But you won so many. He goes, yeah, but we were close on that one.
It's the comedian that kills, but the one guy that didn't laugh is the one that bothers him.
Oh, yeah. You just picture that one woman's face sitting front row at Uncle Vinny's Comedy Club. Why wouldn't you laugh? Dave Attell told me I was funny.
The face of stone.
Wasn't good enough for you? Get this one. The 1919 championship, Thorpe single-handedly wins the game, the title game, on a 95-yard wind-assisted punt. Okay, so he goes out there to punt the ball, and he punts it so far back that they're like, there's not enough time on the clock for this to, like, literally, you're just watching your hopes for the season just sail away. You know, like a balloon just floating away out of reach.
And there it goes.
Yep. But this one was the coolest one. I had no clue on this one. My father, when we research the show together, we'll talk to each other about some stuff and see what's going on. We try to bullshit on the car ride down if we can a little bit. This one fact here is the reason why we decided that it was going to be this episode has to come out for the Super Bowl. In 1920, Thorpe was made the first president of the American Professional Football Association, which would become the National Football League. So Jim Thorpe, the simple native boy from Oklahoma, is now considered technically the first president of the NFL. But here's the wildest part. Thorpe is still a player, and he's also a coach on his own team. So imagine Roger Goodell or Lawrence Taylor, depending on how funny you want to make this for yourself. Lawrence Taylor is, literally ripping people's heads off on the sideline, then also going on the, ripping people's heads off on the sideline, telling them to play harder, then getting on the field and just breaking Joe Theismann's leg, and then also residing over Players Association meetings. All right, guys, that was a good meeting. Anybody?
Yeah. The good news is it's a time saver. You can rip the people's heads off on the field in the huddle.
I told you to play. You can't tackle your own teammates, Taylor. I do what I want. You're right. You're right,
I'm
sir.
I'm changing that rule.
There you go. Note to self, change that rule.
Now, even wilder is this. So he winds up getting replaced to a guy who can do the job a little bit more effectively, who's not going to be, trying to play every Sunday. But in 1923, he played so well for his team that he was actually named to what is considered the NFL's first ever All-Pro team. Okay. Now, sadly, Thorpe never gets to play for an NFL championship team. He retires from sports. His body's just given out. He's not playing like he used to. And he's forced to retire at age 41. Now, what do we know about maybe a certain quarterback from New England that has pretty much decided he's going to be coming back and will be playing at age 44 next season?
Oh, really?
Yeah. If only Jim Thorpe had a little TB12 to him, he could have figured out how to make this all work.
Pop Warner would be played by Bill Belichick.
Dude, that would be perfect, man. I can't hate Belichick. I love him, man. I love him for what he did for the Giants for those 2 years, and I love watching excellence on the field, But as we're wrapping up here, because we got some venison to eat, baby, like we said, in 2005, this one's wild. This one, there's really no record of this. This is kind of like new territory here, that if we're jumping from 1923, when he retires, to 2005, where an old book reveals a ticket that proves that Thorpe actually had also had a quiet basketball career as well.
What?
Baseball, football, gold medals in track, ballroom dancing intercollegiate championships. And yeah, he was also the star player of the LaRue Indians. It's not a very well-documented basketball career, but it has been verified and validated,
yeah.
So I guess basically the takeaway from this is Bo does not know Dudley.
Dude, Bo Jackson is, in my mind, before reading this background on Jim Thorpe, Bo Jackson was to me the greatest athlete of all time. Until I started reading Jim Thorpe's shit.
Yeah.
Holy hell.
Bo only played one position.
That's all he needed to play, unfortunately. The fact that he is now a Bo Hunter is the wildest part of that whole story. But, most athletes, though, this is where he's very uncommon as an athlete until we get to this one part here. Something about athletes and marrying a bunch of women.
He was the original NBA player. He was spreading that seed like Johnny.
Well, like most athletes, he gets married 3 times, winds up having 8 kids. His first wife's name is Ida, who he had met at Carlisle. She was also part Native American.
Someone was in the kitchen with her. Hashtag dad.
That's... The two wind up buying a house together in Oklahoma, and it is known as the Jim Thorpe House. I believe you can still visit it. They had 4 children. Ida files for divorce in 1926 on the grounds of desertion. So, don't... I guess that's kind of similar to what's happening still in a lot of sports places. You know what I mean? Well, it was separated, that kind of a thing. But just a year later, he winds up marrying a woman named Frieda Kirkpatrick. Okay, probably making the Irish half of the family pretty happy. They had 4 more children and were married for 15 years. 15 years is a good run.
It's a good run.
To be married to an athlete, right? Dad, how long have you been married to Mom?
38, working on 39 in February.
I hear you. All right, well... The Uncle Paul, he bet the under on 40, so we'll see what happens.
Okay.
But, yeah, they had, like I said, four more children, make it 15 years until Kirkpatrick divorces him. So now the first wife says that he deserted, and then the second wife just kind of says, I'm done here.
Second wife said, won't leave me alone. This guy can't win.
Well, post-athletic pursuits, Jim is marred by exploitations and excessive alcoholism. He becomes a little bit of a drunkard, okay?
A little stereotype action.
Yeah, you know it. It's he's, like we said, he had to work as a bouncer a couple of times. He's working as an extra in movies. And guess what roles they had him play, Kahuna?
Like background roles and stuff. Background,
and they would have him play a Native American chief. Yep. Right.
And an umpire, I was reading.
Well, that's the weird one. He played an umpire in the Newt Rockne movie. So the world's greatest athlete in a good athlete's movie. So Newt Rockne's not, I shouldn't insult him, but I'm just saying, like, that's like Michael Jordan, you know, being a referee in the Charles Barkley saga. But anyway, as we're wrapping up here, guys, because this is a good episode here, but I'm so hungry. What do you have, LP?
No, you didn't get to marriage number three, I don't think.
Well, we're about to hit that one right now. During the Great Depression, unfortunately, things only got worse for Thorpe. The nation's greatest athlete is, like we said, playing these extra roles. He sold the film rights to his life to MGM.
For $1,500.
What would the Big Kahuna's movie life rights be for your story, buddy?
How much I think they're worth?
Yeah. Would you sell it for $1,500?
I'd do it for $800.
$100 or dollars?
$800. $800, yeah. Maybe a pack of beer.
Yeah, you give me a rent check and a carton of cigarettes, and I'm yours. But, yeah, $1,500, $25,000 in today's money.
Yeah, at this time, too, he's bouncing around. He's moving constantly. He's going from Oklahoma to New York to California to Michigan to Florida to Nevada and stops in between. He's trying everything. He's trying to make a buck. He's trying to make a buck as a football coach, a security guard, ditch digger, house painter, car salesman, bar manager. And you say he was even a Hollywood bit actor. But he's not making it. He's pretty much scraping the bottom.
Well, he does get a movie made about his life starring Burt Lancaster. And Thorpe is paid, like we said, $1,500 extra for the movie and given a small annuity. This winds up proving important because in 1945, he gets remarried for the third time to Patricia Askew. But by the 1950s, he's got no money left. America's greatest athlete is accepted as a charity case for lip cancer in the hospital. And in 1953, in his home in Lomita, California, during dinner. Now, by the way, I said his home.
Yeah.
And my father pointed out he lived in a trailer at this point.
He was in a trailer.
Jim Thorpe dies of heart failure at age 65.
Yeah, he's totally out of shape. You know, he's bloated. He's an alcoholic, I guess, at this particular point in time, too. He dies of a heart attack in his trailer. His wife, Patsy, his third wife, Patsy, leaves the body in the trailer overnight. And it wasn't until friends discovered his death that they raised the money to transport him to a morgue back home and arranged for and paid for a trip back to Oklahoma to bring him back to his homelands, if you will. But things really start going south with that. Now, Thorpe had a total of 8 kids, but his first son, his firstborn, died at the age of 3, and that really tore him up. So he's got 7 kids that are now still living, and the family gets together and decides that they're going to take him home to Oklahoma for his burial, but Patsy is technically in charge, and is varying reports as to what her motivation really was. That did she marry Thorpe as the third wife, really looking to maybe make some money off of being the wife of Jim Thorpe, world's greatest athlete, even though he was on hard times at that particular point. But anyhow, the plan was to take him back to Oklahoma, and he was to be given a traditional sack and fox burial rite, which was a multiple-day kind of a thing. And then he would be taken to the Catholic Church for a Catholic Mass the next morning, and then taken to a mausoleum. In the middle of the Indian burial ceremony, if you will. Patsy drives up with state troopers and a hearse, pulls the body out, and takes Jim's body away and stores him, if you will, in a memorial. And now she's driving all over Oklahoma. The idea was that Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma, was going to build this memorial shrine for Jim Thorpe. That plan goes south. The governor reneges on that. And now she's shopping around all over Oklahoma, the various cities in Oklahoma, to see if find somebody who would pay her and also put up some kind of a mausoleum or something that would be for Jim. Not coming up with anything. She actually goes to a meeting in Philadelphia. Actually, it was NFL headquarters at that particular point in time. And she sees a television program that there's these two little towns in Pennsylvania that are at odds with one another. There's Mauchunk and
East Mauchunk.
One is on one side of the river, the other's on the other side of the river. They're on hard times. That particular area of Pennsylvania, which was a major league coal country, at one time was thriving. Now they're on hard times, and they're looking for something to spark tourism into the area. There was hopes that they were going to have something to draw tourism to that area to revitalize that area. She sees this like on a TV report while she's in Philadelphia speaking to the NFL people, and then drives up to Mauchunk. That's right. Goes up to Mauchunk to talk to these people about, hey, what would you feel about having Jim Thorpe come to your town, and we'll use Jim Thorpe's remains as the tourism attraction, providing that, you know, she gets paid and they decide that they're going to rename East Mauchunk, and Mauchunk will now become Jim Thorpe. The Mauchunk people, they're all about that.
The Munchie Cheese love it.
Yeah, right. They're thinking this is great, and they had hopes of actually bringing the NFL Hall of Fame to Mauchunk as well. So you'd have Jim Thorpe's body right there at the proposed NFL Hall of Fame. Well, they got Jim Thorpe, but they never got anything else besides that. So it was a minor tourism attraction, but it never really materialized into what they had hoped to be. Then there's the sons, not so much the Jim Thorpe's daughters, but the sons are like, they're outraged, because when she first came into the middle of the burial ceremony and took stole the body out of there, they were like so dumbstruck by that, like what the hell are you doing, lady?
Oh,
yeah, that's our father you're taking away, and where are you taking him? And you know, she's all about the whole business of finding some place for Jim, and I guess making a few bucks at the same time. So after this whole thing comes to pass, they rename the town. They do put up a memorial to Jim Thorpe in what is now Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. The sons now file a lawsuit against them. They ask for the body back. First, they started to ask, and guess what? Mauchunk or Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, the town, says no way. So there's all legal acts back and forth. Then there's federal legislation that's enacted that's going to protect Indian burial rights, because there was a number of different instances prior to this, like in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s, where Indian burial grounds are dug up and the remains are being sold off as curiosities. There's one farmer out in Kansas who digs up a burial mound where like 163 bodies or something are discovered, and he's shellacking he's putting a coat of shellac on the bones and selling them for curiosities, kind of a thing. And it became
Well, they're not people, so
so that one. I mean, that's the mindset, Kev.
All right, we're already in overtime here. We gotta go.
We filed. They filed a lawsuit. It went back and forth, and then the Supreme Court. It finally went to the Supreme Court, and they refused to hear the case. So Jim Thorpe is still in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania.
Trapped in Pennsylvania in a town named after you that you didn't want to be in.
The Mark Rick Adonis story.
I'm so sorry we had to rush on that one. We just got we got away from ourselves. That's the problem here. Guys, if you like the show, please check us out.
It was.
We got to rush it to get out of here. I feel so bad for the people that are waiting on us right now. Guys, if you like the show, please give us a review, written review over on iTunes. Check us out on SoundCloud, American Loser Podcast on Instagram. Mark Riccadonna, where can they follow you?
Mark Riccadonna, everything, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
Hell yeah, we got some shows coming up. Larry Burke, I'm very sorry I rushed you, man. I really am. I'm sorry.
The way it goes.
It is. We fucked up on that one. But Cahoons, thank you so much for everything, buddy. And if I had a 20 on me, I'd leave it for you here. We're going to get the fuck out of here. All right, that was Jim Thorpe, American Loser.
An American loser the day I was born. American loser the day I was born. An American loser the day I was born.